Hi everyone, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting EXIT PLAN with no spaces to 44222. That's EXIT PLAN to 44222. Again, text EXIT PLAN to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Hey everyone, thanks so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you with us. If you've been anywhere and heard anything, whether you're watching TV or you've been on a cruise ship or you've been to a Vistage Worldwide type of a meeting, you've probably heard of my next guest. He's been with us many times, and he's always a pleasure to have back on the show, Dr. Jerry Kornfeld, and he is Ask Dr. Jerry. That's how you might know him. Ask Dr. Jerry is a service he provides where you can call and or email in your questions and your tips and get some good medical information from someone who is an experienced medical doctor and is here to help you. So, Dr. Jerry, welcome back to the show, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you, Bill. Great to be with you.
Great to be with you, Dr. Jerry. Happy New Year to you.
And the same to you and everybody.
I hope that it's a breakout year for you and that you're able to really get the message across that you want to get across, which is people can live longer with dignity and style, and they just need to follow some simple rules to get on track and avoid some of the health problems that are facing most of America by doing some simple things. And we're going to talk about that today. And first of all, I wanted to start off by asking you, you've been doing how many speeches and dissertations and that type of thing? How many did you end up doing last year? Do you know?
You know, I didn't put a total count in, but it was quite a few. And what's taking a lot of my time, as I think I mentioned to you now, is I'm doing these talks for the retirement villages on Living to 100 with Quality. And I'm doing a series of five talks. So I've got quite a bill. I didn't keep track of the numbers, Bill, but I did quite a few.
That's great. Well, that's the key is to keep up the activity, keep doing what you're doing, and get the word out about how people can live to 100. Again, like you say, the most important two words, with quality. So let's talk a little bit about what's new with you. You know, one of the questions we've had from some people is it's frequently asked, how long is a prescription good for, and what about that date on the bottle?
Oh, well, that probably is one of the most common questions that cause much anxiety amongst many, many patients, because you get a prescription, and it's got a date on it that it expires. And you don't use it all up, and maybe a year passes, and all of a sudden you get a similar type of a problem. Doctor wants to put you back on that same medication. You got it at home, but you're afraid to take it because the date is expired. So what has happened? It's really fascinating about this. The military, interestingly enough, had a major problem. They had a warehouse filled with drugs, and they were all outdated. And they were about to reorder all of those drugs for all of their military needs. When some smart officer got the idea that, well, how do we know these drugs really are not any good just because the data is on there? So they did a survey. They studied the drugs to find out if they were still valid. Guess what they found? Lo and behold, Bill, most of those drugs still had strong validity, and now they come up with this conclusion, the military came up with this conclusion, that these drugs are good for at least 5 years after the data on the bottle. Oh. Now, the one exception are liquids, because liquids don't last as long. But you have a pill or a capsule, the military's conclusion is that they're good for at least 5 years. So you know, nobody wants to accuse the pharmaceutical companies of doing that. They're just trying to play safe, I guess. But that's a very important question. So always, always check with your own doctor and make sure that your doctor agrees with that and he wants you to use that medication. But this is the study that was done by the military, and it's been published, and it's just, it's changed the whole way that we think about how long a drug is good for.
Well, that's good to know, because I'm what do you think about things like over the counter, like vitamins and things along those lines? Would those be different, do you think?
Well, I don't know if they did any surveys on those. It depends upon what the product is and what it's being used for, the validity. But I would think that this stuff, most of it has a date that's longer than the date that's on the bottle. How long exactly?
Yeah.
I said the military came up with a 5-year thing. How long exactly? But, you know, if you have something and it's a year old, I think I would probably still use it based upon that study.
Well, that's great to know. That's great to know. And a lot of people are, you know, will go in and out of phases of either needing something or using something. So that's good information to know. Now, we want to talk today about a new area of research in heart disease, because it's the number one killer out there. So let's get into that, because I think that's a real exciting topic for our listeners to understand. You know, what do they need to know and what's happening in that area?
Well, you know, Bill, this is my favorite subject. It's a topic I wrote my book about. It's a topic I love to do the talks about. You know, the book, Your 100-Year Heart, goes into all these details. But new stuff is constantly coming on the horizon, and I spend every day researching, looking to see the latest things. And there's something that's happening right now. It's been in research for a couple of years, some work that's being done at the Cleveland Clinic and other places, looking at a very interesting phenomenon. The phenomenon, we've talked about this, and that is that red meat is associated with an increase in sudden cardiac death, studies that were done at Harvard and other places. And we've also talked about the fact that red meat has some risk factors, and we really think that all the studies that have been done indicating that red meat as a precursor for heart disease are all very, very valid. Well, we knew about it. We thought this was probably the cholesterol, the saturated fat that I've talked about, depositing the walls of the arteries. But Cleveland Clinic and other facilities have some fascinating study, because they're now talking about the fact that this red meat was involved. They're looking to see why was it involved. We always thought that was because of the cholesterol, saturated fat. Well, they have come up with a new concept, and it has to do with the bacteria in your gut. This is really fascinating. We always are concerned about the environment and how the environment is harming us, but the one area of the environment that we don't pay much attention to is the foods we put in our body. And this study started to look at the relationships of the bacteria in your gut and cholesterol deposition and heart disease. And they've come up with a very significant finding. They've come up with the fact that this bacteria that's in your intestine, when the food comes into your body and the food has in it something called choline, that choline is metabolized by the bacteria in your gut to a product that we called initials TMAO. And those are initials that you want to start remembering, because they're going to be as important as cholesterol. Up until now, we've used cholesterol as one of the indicators. We measure cholesterol, we look at the HDL, the LDL component of the cholesterol, and we come up with some statistics of how we want to treat you with the statins, et cetera. Well, they're coming up now, and they're finding out that the TMAO is a significant factor. Remember now, it's the bacteria in your gut that's working on this choline that's coming in. And where is the choline coming in? What foods are bringing the choline into your body? Well, red meat. Red meat is high in choline, so are eggs, so are dairy products. It's in a lot of foods, but red meat seems to be the highest level. You eat the red meat, it brings the choline into your body. This bacteria in your gut works on it, metabolizes it, and forms this product called TMAO. TMAO. That works on the ability of this cholesterol to be formed. It then makes the cholesterol a little more active. It inflames the arteries in the heart, and because of it, plaque starts to break off, and there's a heart attack. It's just a whole fascinating new concept. So we're going to start talking about cholesterol and the bugs that are in your intestinal tract. And this is amazing. We have all these bugs in our body. You know, we talk about probiotics. Are you familiar with probiotics?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, I've heard
of probiotics. We talk about probiotics,
yeah.
And we're talking about taking them because they're good for the digestive tract, et cetera. But we're also talking about the fact these are good bacteria. And then now there's suspicion that the probiotics may be playing a role in keeping these harmful bugs that are in your intestine from doing its work on the choline. So it's a fascinating concept. Because it's a whole new area that we're going to start measuring. They're not doing it routinely yet all over, but the Cleveland Clinic, they're doing these tests, these choline studies and the TMO studies, and they're looking to see what effect it's having. And the results, as I said, are fascinating. So it's 2017. All kinds of new stuff is coming up. So for the new year, I want to give you a whole new concept of what we're thinking about now as causing elevated cholesterol. And this whole concept of heart disease and the plaque that forms with the heart disease.
Perfect. I have my pencil ready. Go ahead. So, Dr. Jerry, let me ask you a question before we move on there. So you said red meat and also eggs, and what other types of foods create choline?
Dairy products.
Dairy.
Okay. So those are the three most. Choline is found in many, many foods, but it seems to have its highest levels in those three groups of foods. And those three groups of foods are the foods, remember I talked about DEA, you know, the bywords that I go by, the acronym, D stands for diet, E stands for exercise, A stands for attitude. Well, here we find that DEA, again, as I told you, it is the beginning of all of the disease processes. I'm a firm believer, and I told all my audiences about longevity, that DEA plays a role because it's all your lifestyle. We know for a fact, and I repeat myself, I know, but it's such important stuff. Your lifestyle is the precursor to your longevity. So here we go back to DEA. The very first thing is diet, the foods you put in your body. And lo and behold, now we're coming up with the fact that the bacteria in your intestinal tract, there's good bacteria and bad bacteria. You know, when we give you antibiotics, the thing we worry about is the antibiotics are going to kill the bad bug and get rid of the disease, but in the same process, it's going to kill the good bug. So you get some side effects from that, and that's why we like to recommend taking in these probiotics. Well, here we now we're coming up with a whole new concept of the relationship of these bad bugs and heart disease. It's just a fascinating, fascinating area relative to how we're going to be treating it, Now, what they're suggesting doing as far as treatment is concerned, is number one, probiotics. So I'm recommending now, and I've been doing it for a while before this news came out, that everybody on a daily basis take probiotics. These are the good bacteria that your body is going to be replacing because of antibiotics or other things. Plus, they play a tremendous role in digestion, in the digestive process, and now we're saying they play a role in heart disease. So it's a very, very positive area. So 2017 is starting off with a very exciting bang.
That's great. Now, I know with probiotics, I've seen, you know, there's yogurts that promote that they have a lot of probiotics in them. There's pill form. Is there a preferred way to get probiotics into your body?
Well, before probiotics came on the market, there's a bacteria in your intestine, a good bacteria called lactobacillus. That lactobacillus is the good bacteria that you kill off when you take antibiotics. Well, yogurt is a great source of lactobacillus. So is buttermilk, so are all these products. So we've always recommended, especially ladies who have a vaginal infection, have a chance of getting another problem, we suggest to take probiotics or lactobacillus when they're taking the antibiotics. Well, now they're available in capsules. The problem is there's so many different ones on the market. You go into the stores and you'll see about five or six different probiotics. And it all has to do with the billions of bacteria in the product. The number of bacteria that they list is what controls the validity of the probiotic. So you want to have something that's got at least 3 to 5 billion bacteria in a capsule. And it should have more than one. It should have more than one bacteria. So look at the label carefully. But the best way to get them now, the simplest way, is just with the capsules.
Yeah, especially on you know, in light of the fact that the dairy product is not preferable, it sounds like, for the choline.
Yeah, the dairy products have the choline.
If you take it by yogurt. Then, yeah.
Well, yogurt has it, but it's got all the lactobacillus in it, which makes up for that. So I'd be mostly concerned, as I have told you before, about the red meats. The dairy products, you can switch up to the non-fat dairy products, so you won't have the cholesterol issue.
Yeah. And there are, of course, it seems like there would be other factors with that, like how digestible is the food that you're eating, where red meat is not as digestible as, say, something in egg form or dairy products, I would imagine.
Well, Bill, I don't get too concerned about that because your digestive system is prepared to handle most of the stuff you need as far as digestion is concerned. But we do worry about the things that you're getting that you don't want to get, and that is the cholesterol and now this TMAO business. Mm-hmm. That's the stuff. And the choline, which is in a lot of foods. Choline is in a lot of foods, but it seems that the levels are the highest in those three groups of foods, which are also the same groups of foods that we say to avoid when I talk about DEA on the diet aspect. So it's also fitting into place, but it's giving us a new statistic. By the way, measuring TMAO is going to be a routine thing done. And the thing that's really fascinating about it is that TMAO levels are three times more indicative of heart disease. So cholesterol levels we are concerned about, but TMAO levels are going to be three times more indicative of heart disease and, of course, potential heart attacks. So if your TMAO levels are high, that is going to be a great, great indicator of you having a future heart attack. So that'll probably be available. I'm not sure how soon it's going to be in doctor's offices, but I know the Cleveland Clinic is using it routinely right now.
If you're getting ready to get your annual physical and your doctor requests a blood panel, should you perhaps request that they ask for that level in case they aren't doing that yet?
Yeah, it certainly cannot hurt to ask for a TMAO, but I don't think it's generally available in doctor's offices yet. This is something that's new. It's been around for a couple of years, statistics, research, et cetera, but now they're coming out with all this exciting stuff. So keep it in mind. Keep it down with you. And no question, when you're in the office, mention it to your doctor and see if they're doing the test routinely yet. I think it's going to be a little bit of a while, maybe this year, maybe next year, but it's something to be aware of, something to be aware of.
That's great information.
Exciting. Yeah.
That's great information.
There's one other thing relative to that. Any questions about this before I go on to a little bit different subject?
No, Dr. Jerry, it's always great to have you on. You're always five steps ahead of the rest of us, so that's great information to know. Thank you very much for that. So, no, I'm good.
Well, one other thing I want to add, because it's something that statistically has just come out. You know, we keep track every year of the incidence of coronary artery disease. And with all the programs that we have out there and with the statin drugs and with folks giving lectures and writing papers and I'm talking about DEA, et cetera, we have observed that the incidence of coronary artery disease has been decreasing. And we're pretty excited about that from the medical profession. But lo and behold, the numbers just came out for 2015. And much to our unhappiness, the number went up in 2015. And so all this stuff that I'm getting out, I'm working hard now to get it out because something happened in 2015 that they're not really sure about yet. 2016 statistics won't be in for a while yet, but 2015 the numbers went up, and they're looking to see why that is. So I urge everybody, let's make 2017 a fantastic year. Let's get those numbers down. Let's get heart disease out of our vocabulary, and let's take it away from being the number one killer. That's my goal for 2017.
That's a great goal. And one other statistic I heard somewhere along the line was that it might have been a couple years old numbers by now, but they were just announcing that the life expectancy actually did not lengthen in the last couple of years. It actually shortened by a month or two.
Yes,
did you hear that statistic?
Yes, absolutely. Those numbers went down. And again, they are not sure what may be due to. But those numbers are changing a little bit in the past year because we have been increasing our longevity, as we've talked about before. Mm-hmm. You know, we've doubled our longevity in the past 100 years. So we've been increasing it statistically. But something happens. A fluke occurs, and they're looking to see what that fluke is. And hopefully they'll find it, and we'll be able to correct it.
Well, I certainly hope so. And, of course, if people want to get in touch with you, tell them the best way to do that if they have a question or if they want to ask you to speak at their event, especially for seniors or on cruise ships or if they're Vistage Worldwide members. What's the best way for them to reach you, Dr. Jerry?
Okay, absolutely correct. I want to reemphasize that Ask Dr. Jerry is available to all of your audiences, and there's no fee for this. I'll give you my email address. You have a question, I'm not going to diagnose or treat you, but I certainly can answer your question. So Ask Dr. Jerry. You can reach me at my email, KJ, as in Jerry, B, as in Bob, KORN, KJB Korn, at AOL, KJB KORN at AOL. You email me, you have a question, I'll get back to you. But all of your audiences, I welcome your questions, and I do this with every audience I speak to. Ask Dr. Jerry is available to answer your questions. So you email me, and I'll get back to you, I guarantee it.
Excellent. Well, so good to have you on again, and I wish you all the best for the new year, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again soon, Dr. Jerry. Thanks so much.
Looking forward to it. Thanks again, Bill.
We'll take a short break. We'll be right back after.
Hey, everybody. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us. Hey, I've had my next guest on the show before, and she is awesome. So you're going to really enjoy this. Sue Coach is with Three Squares Coaching and Consulting here in Irvine, California. She's written a book called Sexy Second Act, and she works primarily with baby boomers who are ready to design a sexy second act that combines passion, purpose, and a paycheck. And we're going to talk all about that, because I know a lot of you are out there thinking about, how am I going to re-engineer my life after I so-called retire? That's a myth, isn't it, these days? I call it rewiring, because more people leave the current job or situation they're in and start something new, saying either I need to or I want to continue to be active and do something that I think is going to be fun. So let's talk about not only fun, but a sexy second act. Sue, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me back. It's good to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. I know you've been busy. You've got some workshops coming up we're going to talk about a little bit, and been working on getting your book out there. Tell our listeners who didn't hear your last interview a little bit about you and how you got into this line of coaching and what you do.
Okay. Well, I'm a career and life design coach, and I do work with baby boomers. Really are kind of at a loss to figure out what it is, the direction that they want to do next. That's my favorite thing. I come out of a corporate background myself. I was downsized out of my company in 2002, right after 9/11, and in that face of I'm too young to retire, I can't collect my Social Security or my benefits, so what the heck am I going to do with my life? I didn't want to continue doing what I was doing. Luckily, I had been coaching as a volunteer in a particular organization, and I found that I loved it and continued on that path to get some more education, and it's kind of been evolving ever since. It's been a lot of fun.
That's great. Hey, Sue, every so often your voice is cutting out a little bit. Are you on a landline with us?
I am. Me.
Okay.
How's this?
Okay. If that's the way it is, that's the way it is. There's nothing much we can do about it. I just want to make sure it wasn't on a headset or something like that that was cutting out every once in a while. It'll be all okay, and we'll have our editors work on this for our radio show. But, Sue, so tell us a little bit about the idea of the sexy second act. It combines passion, purpose, and a paycheck. I love that saying. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. Hopefully this will be a little better. I've got the phone a little closer to me. So I think the baby boomer generation, you know, we started out as young people wanting to make a difference in the world, thinking that we could do it easily because we had the energy, we had the passion, but I don't know that we had the skills or the experience to be able to do it. We had the passion. I don't know that we even had the purpose, because sometimes as a young person you aren't really life experienced enough to know what that is. But now in the second half of life, as we're looking at how we want to go out, I think, we're looking at what do I want to leave behind? What kind of a legacy do I want to leave? What matters to me? And how can I use what matters to me to make a difference in the world? And that difference can bring you a paycheck, or that difference can bring you the rewards of having made a contribution and made a difference and left a legacy. I think that's individual and up to each person. So that's really where passion, purpose, and a paycheck come together. What do you love? What has meaning for you? And how can you use those two things to give back in a way that matters to you?
And, you know, one thing that comes to mind when I think of baby boomers, and I am one, by the way, but I'm not like the baby boomers. For those of you who haven't done the math, this is 2017. The baby boomers are now age 51, 52, 53, 1946 to 1964. So 1946, so they're 70. They can be 72 years old this year, right? Baby boomers could be in their mid-50s to the early 70s these days. Now, you think about that range of technology aptitude and the ability, when a lot of these people started, they were given a job description, they were given tasks to do, and they did them for the next 30 to 40 years under changing circumstances with technology coming in and all that. But then a lot of people now are stepping back going, what's out there? I don't even know what's out there. And so is that where you come in to help them understand? Let's figure out what you want to do, and then let me tell you what's out there that you can use as tools and resources that you might not even be aware of.
Yeah, I do a little bit of that. I really start off with what matters to you, because I think it's something that has to start from the inside out. And it's kind of a DIY now, because as you say, the baby boomers are turning into their 70s now, still can have maybe at least 20, 30 years of active life left. How many games of golf can you play? How many TV programs can you watch before you just want to die because you're bored to death? So it's looking at, like, really what's next? How can I take the things that matter to me, whether it's homeless people or doesn't really matter, and use my talents to make a contribution in that area? Then we look at the design and what's out there. But first, you know, people shut down quite often around that question very early because they're thinking, oh, I can't start a business now. I'm too old. I'm not technology literate enough, whatever it is. And you have to kind of give up those conversations and let yourself play like a little kid in a sandbox. Like, what would you build if you could build anything you wanted to? And then let's look for where the passion is, and then we can deal with the details of it later, because your brain is really creative at problem solving. It can solve that problem. But getting to that thing that's going to energize you for the next 20 or 30 years is the tough part, because we don't think we have the ability to be able to create it. So why even bother? It's where our brains go sometimes.
And that is probably a huge part of it, I would imagine, because a lot of people that I know and that I've seen and witnessed might have swallowed their dreams a long time ago when they realized, you know, I've always wanted to do X, but I have to do Y, because Y pays the bills and pays the money and gets the kids through college and builds a retirement plan and all that type of thing. And so a lot of people may have swallowed that drive and ambition a long time ago, and now they need to find it again. So
yes.
How do you start getting people to open up their minds in that area?
Sometimes it's as simple as making a list. You know, like write down a list of, you could call it a bucket list or something, but write down a list of 50 to 100 things that you would love to do before you die. And sometimes that will just open up the creative process, because people will be daunted about 50 things. Are you kidding me? But you'd be surprised if you start writing things down and you keep that list out someplace where you can go back and look at it. Quite often, you're going to add things to it. And then I ask people to rate them, like, what's the really red-hot things? What are the things that are sort of the nice to-dos? And what are the things that are kind of eh? And then we'll hone in on the things that really have a lot of juice and energy, even if it's something you abandoned as a kid, like taking piano lessons or singing or something like that. Just focusing in on those things are going to open up new possibilities, at least in your thinking, and then we can go from there.
That's great. So starting off with kind of a brainstorm, an internal brainstorming session, and then, of course, I would imagine one of your gifts is that you can help turn some sparks that people have into fire after that, right? Just helping them take that further.
Yes, and giving themselves permission to take it further without censoring anything. And that's, you know, the beauty of a brainstorming process is just to do that. Don't censor it. Don't try to, you know, have your mind come in and say, oh, that's ridiculous. Just write it down, and then we'll work with it if it's something that you're really hot on to.
Makes sense. Now, in your book, Sexy Second Act, you say that words create your world. Can you give us an example of how that works?
Yeah, today'd be a pretty good example, actually. So let's say you wake up and you discover it's raining outside. So in one scenario, you might start thinking, ain't it awful thoughts, like, oh, God, it's raining again. I'm so sick of the rain. I just want to go back to sleep. Traffic's going to be awful. I'll probably be late to work. My whole day's ruined. And if you're really good at it, you're going to go on down that path to making a mental list of why your whole life sucks, always did, and always will.
Right, yeah.
And then there's another scenario where you might get up, it's raining outside, you think, it's raining, and maybe you love how the rain smells, how the air smells when it rains, and you might think, well, you know, you better leave a few minutes early for work, because the traffic's probably not going to be great, and oh, I better put my umbrella in the car too, and isn't it great that we're getting all this rain, we need it, maybe I should check to see what the weather's doing this weekend in the mountains, maybe I'll go skiing, make plans to go skiing. So who do you think out of those two people is going to have a better day?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the second person, obviously. Yeah, they're going to be looking positively at everything that happens, and that's going to attract positivism.
I think so, because who do you think is going to be more fun to be around that day?
Absolutely. So are you saying that all we have to do is think positively?
Not at all, because I heard someone say one time that thinking positively is kind of like putting icing on a cow patty. It might look pretty on the outside, but underneath it still stinks. So sometimes I think that's what happens with positive thinking. And things happen in life that really aren't much fun. We get sick or we get divorced or we lose our job or whatever. So there's a reality about living that we have to deal with.
But instead of dealing with reality as it happens, we add all kinds of meaning to our circumstances. And so reality, we have to allow ourselves to feel what we feel about them, whether that's hurt or grief or fear. Positive thinking doesn't allow you to do with that. You're just putting icing on a cow patty. So you have to really acknowledge those feelings. But on the other hand, there was a friend of mine who posted this amazing story on Facebook yesterday about a San Francisco man who ended up as a triple amputee because he was in an accident and he almost died. And the story is really long, but the crux of it was that he came through it eventually, and he ended up creating a really amazing life where he doesn't let his physical challenges stop him. He even rides a motorcycle. So he went on to found a hospice that deals with death in a way that each patient feels really cherished and that they get to have their death experience as they want to have it rather than most hospices deal with it. So it's not about positive thinking. It's about looking at how can we use our circumstances in a way that empowers us rather than makes us a victim of life.
Wow. That's incredible. Now, let's go back to that person who was laying in bed and looking out and saying it's raining, it's not going to be a good day. What can they do at that moment, or what should they do to put themselves right in their mind?
Well, I think first of all, you know, that little voice in our heads goes on and rambles and says all kinds of stuff, and we don't pay much attention to it. We just let it ramble, and we think that that rambling is real, and it's the truth. It's just rambling. So I think one of the things we can do is interrupt that and say, uh-oh, there I am on that ain't it awful path again. What can I do to interrupt that? Sing a song, dance, you know, spin around. Anything you can do to interrupt the pattern for yourself and just notice the pattern of your thinking. And then look at, well, what's really good about today? What can I enjoy about the rain? What matters to me that is more important than whether or not it's raining outside? Something like that. And just noticing is the beginning of interrupting it.
Just being cognizant that you're going down that path, right?
Yeah, awareness.
That your inner mind, right. And then I don't know, you know, how many personalities we have to combat that, but the mind is a strange thing, isn't it? I mean, you have, it's like, well, here I feel like this, and it's like, well, wait a minute. You don't have to feel like that. There's a little battle going on inside of our heads. Do you condone something like waking up with an attitude of gratitude, that is, you know, as soon as you wake up, some kind of an exercise to help people start off on a positive attitude?
Absolutely. I think you can absolutely start with that. Or you can do something before you get up. Gratitude is a really great way. I end my day that way, but you could also begin it. You could create an intention for the day. So what would your intention be? It could be the intention of focus, perhaps, or the intention of going with the flow on a rainy day.
Mm-hmm.
Or the intention of being playful, you know. You might go outside and jump in a puddle or something, like a little kid. But then a lot of people advocate starting with an intention, but they kind of stop there, and they don't align or pick some actions that would align with that intention, because you want something specific and measurable. So let's say you pick focus. Well, you might get to a report that you've been putting off. Or in going with the flow, you might take a walk every couple of hours in the rain or something. Or you might schedule a tennis date to be playful. So there are things, actions that you can take that would align with the intention you create with that day. And then the end of the day, you go to bed. You can debrief yourself about whether you actually completed the actions. And if you did, you give yourself a high five. And if you didn't, you still give yourself a high five because you gave it a shot. And if you got off track, you can ask yourself what you could do differently tomorrow and maybe create a new intention around it. So if you practice that every day, pretty soon you're going to be setting bigger intentions for maybe your week or your month or your year, and you won't have to set New Year's resolutions. You're going to be creating a vibrant, sexy second act that's run by high-energy actions, and you're going to attract high-energy people and high-energy opportunities, and you're not going to have time to let negativity set you back for very long.
Just like a lot of things, you need to work at it. You need to have a process and a plan to work at it. And again, for our listeners, there's the sexy second act idea is, how are you going to rewire yourself? And when should people start thinking about that, Sue? If they're sitting around doing nothing, they're thinking, I got to do something. That's one time. But should people be thinking about this before they retire from their job or before they sell their company or that type of a thing? Should they be setting up that purpose in advance?
Absolutely. You know, in one case, I was just working with a client who has a job now. He's not very happy with it. He's younger. He's not a baby boomer. He's not very happy with it. He really doesn't know what direction to go in. So he's starting now, and he's got a family, so he's got responsibilities. He's got things that he has to take care of. And for him, maybe there'll be some kind of a side hustle, a part-time something that he starts now and builds, and then by the time he's ready to make the jump, enough things will be in place that he'll feel more secure about doing it. So I think the sooner the better, and it's never too late to begin again. As long as you're healthy and you have the energy and the desire, I don't think it's ever too late. So it's never too early and it's never too late.
Well, I appreciate that, because I work with a lot of business owners, and I know that the ones that have a purpose and a passion for what they're going to do next find it a lot easier to move on from what they've been doing for the last 30 to 40 years. So it's very helpful. And again, your book is called Sexy Second Act: Remodel Your Life with Passion, Purpose, and a Paycheck. Look for that on Amazon and Kindle under the author's name, Sue Koch, K-O-C-H. And you have a complimentary course coming up, a teleclass called Sexy Second Act: Creating Goals That Matter, on Thursday, January 19th at 6 p.m. Pacific. So how do our listeners tune into that?
Well, they can register. I'm busy getting the website updated right now, so it's probably best if they email me, sue@threesquarescoaching.com, and I will send them the dial-in information so that they can join the class if they'd like to.
Okay, so that's sue@three, which is spelled out T-H-R-E-E, squares, plural, coaching.com, sue@threesquarescoaching.com. And Sue, you're always a ray of sunshine for us, especially here on a gloomy Southern California day. It's nice to have you on the show. Thanks so much for coming on. Thanks for the great work that you're doing, because it's an important time of life for a lot of people in transition to think about, you know, where do I go from here? I don't even know where to start, and I don't want to just go get a job somewhere that's just a continuation of maybe of something that I've been doing. I want to do something I want to do, I have a passion for. So thank you for your work.
Well, you're welcome. My goal is to have people live a passionate, sexy life, and the more of us that are doing that, the better the world is going to be.
Well, we appreciate it, and hope you'll come back and join us again sometime.
I'd love to.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this. Please stay with us.
Hey, everybody, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you with us. My next guest is Michael Beck from Michael Beck International in Hillsboro, Oregon. And Michael Beck International, it's a executive development firm that specializes in developing successors in order to facilitate successful exit strategies. Today, we're going to talk about critical factors for successor effectiveness. Michael, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Bill, thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to work with experts like you.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to have you on. I want to hear all about your topic because it's something that I find a lot of business owners deal with these days. Is like, okay, I know I want to leave, and I know I probably want to keep it on the inside here, the transition, but I've got some work to do with my people and determining who's going to be an effective leader. And the strategies, I mean, especially if there's, say, I have situations with 3 children on the next level, how do we figure out the strategy there? So I hope we're going to talk about stuff like that. I imagine we are. But tell us a little bit about you and your firm and how you got started in this business before we get into that.
Fantastic. So I came from a really varied background. I worked as an employee in small companies. I worked as an employee in large companies. I worked as an owner. I was in a partnership, and it gave me a really broad perspective of effective leadership, effective ownership, and frankly saw a lot of poor leadership out of that. And then got into executive coaching because I felt that I could do a greater service from outside of a company than from within it. And so over the 16, 17 years I've been doing that, have worked with business owners, worked with corporate executives, and now we've built into an organization where I've got coaches around the country, and we specialize in developing successors. And all of us are passionate about helping companies and their leaders bring out the best in people. We work with clients in the typically the $10 million to $100 million range, but we've worked with clients from just about every profession and industry.
That's great. That's great. And when you say all over the world, are there specific areas that you have a high concentration in specific parts of the world?
Well, I was saying all over the country. We have had clients in other parts of the world, but most of our clients are throughout the U.S. And North America, so Canada as
okay.
well. And
fair.
A lot of the work we do is virtual. A lot of the work
yeah.
we do is virtual, so it's conducted over the phone and allows us to work with people anywhere they are.
Yeah, it's people issues. I mean, it's people issues, and I would imagine that space you're talking about, Michael, that a lot of businesses, even if they don't call themselves a family business, there's family membership involved in that size of a business. Is that right?
There is, and there's, like you had mentioned earlier in our segment here, that it's not simply family members, but even if the exit or the succession is being handed over to capable managers within the company who aren't family
right.
members, there's a difference between owning a company and being employed by one. And then,
absolutely
of course,
right.
when you add family members, right? And when you add family members, then there's that other, the whole other facet of the family interaction, the relationship interactions as well.
It's like if you had a panel of toggle switches and you started toggling, you know, okay, how complicated is this situation going to be? Number one, I want to pass it on to people that don't have any money. To toggle that.
Right.
Number two, I have a key employee or I have one key employee, and that person's going to take over. Toggle that switch. Now you have another switch that says I have more than one key employee, and now I got to figure out how they're going to deal, how they're going to manage the business together. And then you have the whole panel that's all family members, and you start toggling a lot of switches, and pretty soon the complexity level gets very, very difficult because you're dealing with more than what happens here at the office. It's when you get into the family situation, it becomes, how do we keep happy Thanksgivings forever? That's a very different scenario. But let's just not focus so much on the family side of things, because that's very complicated, as we all know. But let's get down into this. What are some of the common pitfalls that can undermine a successor's effectiveness in leading a company?
Oh, good question, Bill. So one of the challenges that an owner who's exiting needs to be mindful of is whether the successor will be making decisions and changes emotionally, in other words, to prove him or herself as the new owner, rather than making those decisions strategically. Because making a change for the sake of making the change often leads to bad results. So that's one pitfall that is actually common. Another one, and we alluded to this a few minutes ago, is that when you think about it, the person who will be, or the people who will be succeeding, up to that point have been employees. And there's a tendency to continue to think like an employee rather than to think like an owner. So this is another pitfall. The third, and this is just obviously true with family issues, is relying on family status to garner trust and respect rather than actually earning it by their actions and words. So those are some common pitfalls. Obviously, there are many things involved in being an effective leader.
Yes. But those are huge. The ones that I'm just taking those in because those are huge, the ones that you just mentioned, especially the thinking like an employee when it's time to think like an owner. And that can even affect the small business owner who's never had to, who really is more of the operator. You know, they call them owner operators. They're really operating.
Right.
They're really the operator. They don't know how to think like just the owner. They wouldn't know if they said, well, you can't work here on a day-to-day basis anymore. Now you're going to be the owner. I run into a lot of these. I'm sure you do. And they just go, well, what does that mean? What do I do with that? So for an employee who's been subject to someone else's authority, and they've never had, you know, free range to do things, they really need to understand what that's all about. So how do you help them get there?
As a good observation, Bill. And believe it or not, it's actually very comparable to what happens in the corporate world when someone is promoted up into an executive role. They're still thinking like a doer rather than a leader. And so the question you asked is, how do you help someone transition from thinking like the person who's responsible for doing the work to someone responsible for leading the company? And it clearly takes a shift in perspective. And usually what I'll do is ask somebody if they're actually not responsible for doing the work, then what are they responsible for? And many times they can't answer that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you begin shifting how they view their role, because the tendency is to feel like if I'm not producing widgets, I'm not being productive. And as we know as an owner, that's not the case. Owners need to take a strategic perspective. They need to look at the bigger picture. They need to look at what's happening outside of their company. And when they realize that's the bigger role, that they realize they don't know how to do it, number one, but now at least they're willing to go down that path.
Yeah, it's changing from, and I've used this example with business owners. It's if you're on a big ship, you're no longer in the engine room. Now you're the navigator. You're up top in the engine room. I mean, in the where the steering wheel is, in the very top of the ship, looking down the path. It's a very different role. You don't just get there overnight. It takes a lot of transition. And the same with, again, these successors. How far in advance should business owners be thinking about this? Because we talk to a lot of baby boomer business owners who are, early 50s to the early 70s, and they're saying, maybe 5 years out or 5 or 10 years out, I want to be doing something different. Should they be thinking about this now as part of their planning?
I'm glad you asked that question, Bill. Let me explain it this way. There's no such thing as leadership training. You can't train people to do this. It's a developmental process. It takes time. And situations have to arise and perspectives have to be changed. And so it absolutely takes, really it takes years to get there. Surely a year of a concentrated effort, of development effort. But it's not something you can give someone a book to read and all of a sudden
right. They're
a leader and an owner. So definitely they need to start grooming that person, not in the mechanics. See, here's the problem. Owners tend to groom their folks in the mechanics of the business. That's not the issue. The issue is the judgment and the strategic thinking and the whole perspective of being an owner rather than an employee. That takes time to shift. Because now they're dealing with their level of self-confidence, the interactions in the family, if it's a family issue. They're dealing with judgment, learning how to think correctly as an owner, and being proactive rather than reactive. There's a whole slew of stuff that has to take place.
I totally get what you're saying, and I think that I've seen situations, I'm sure you have too, where not only does the owner think all I have to do is give them the title and everybody's going to respect them or look at them differently, but they don't know themselves how to transition. So how are they going to pass that on to the next line of successor management? And I think part of it might be, and let me ask you a question from your experience, there's probably behaviors that successors need to stop in order to successfully run a company. So let's talk about that. What do they need to stop doing as a successor?
That's a good observation because there are behaviors they need to stop and behaviors they need to develop. So the ones they need to stop, if you think about the role that they're leaving and then think about the role they're entering, typically they need to stop managing. It's not about managing activity. It's about leading people. And like you said earlier, thinking strategically, looking into the future. So that's one behavior. Another behavior, and it kind of goes hand in hand with that, is they need to shift. They need to stop focusing on tactics and instead focus on strategies. So tactics are about how we're going to get something accomplished, where the strategy is actually the direction that those tactics should be taking them in. And it's a different mindset, and I've seen executives at all levels in all kinds of corporations and companies not get that distinction. They need to stop thinking like we've talked about, like an employee, and adopt an owner's mindset. The other, it's a really interesting dynamic that they have to stop. Typically, and in fact, I had a conversation about this with someone last evening. That successor needs to stop relying on the blessing of the owner. Mm-hmm. In other words, at some point they have to be confident enough that they got it right and not simply rely on the owner, because otherwise they don't earn the trust and respect of their folks, and the owner who is trying to exit actually can't extricate themselves. Just a couple more things that I wanted to mention. They need to avoid or stop any feelings of entitlement. Just because they're the family member does not make them in charge or earn them respect or trust. It doesn't work like that. And then the last one I wanted to mention, the sixth one, is that the successors need to stop being reactive. Many times employees are reactive. This happens, they know what to do. And instead, an owner needs to become proactive and anticipate things.
That's great. That is a great summary of very important transitional activities that need to take place. And I can imagine if we're talking, number one, about things that that successors coming up need to stop doing and start doing, very close to that is the things that the owner, the outgoing owner, needs to stop doing. And, you know, do you have a list like that for us, or are we just talking about successors today?
I'm really glad you asked that. I hadn't planned on discussing it, but that is spot on. See, one of the challenges is that, as you know, owners are in charge, and they're used to having the buck stop with them. And the consequence is if they don't allow successors to make decisions, the successor doesn't learn how to make decisions. If the owner doesn't allow a successor to make mistakes, the successor doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know the difference between a mistake, a bad call, and a good call. And so owners need to stop holding everything tight to the vest, and they need to start mentoring and coaching the successor.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, it's really about the owner giving up total authority. And
yes.
You
and
don't
I'll,
just...
I'll
you,
add,
it's not a light
I'll
switch,
add
right?
a little bit. Exactly. And I'll add a little bit to that if I could. It's they've got to stop micromanaging and start dashboard managing. Well, you know, there's a transition period, right? I mean, all these owners that are listening to this and that are out there that are saying, I want to be out of this thing. Well, you just said it. You want to be out of this thing, you got to start down the road to being out of this thing. And you need to stop micromanaging and start dashboard management of your company and think about how you're going to grow shareholder value as the outgoing CEO. What are you going to do to leave your legacy and grow your value? Sometimes you have to grow your value so that the company can afford to buy you out, number one.
Yep.
So there's a lot to that.
No, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head on this thing. If they keep – well, if they're micromanaging, it's a problem in and of itself. But
yes.
If they're holding all the reins and they're keeping their thought process private and their judgment private and not developing the successor's judgment and thinking – then they're undermining the success. And as you know, the majority of these exits are self-funded. In other words, the company pays for the value out of future cash flow. And so it's no surprise that the studies have shown that 70% of exits fail.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I mean, it's a big deal. You can maximize the value all you want, but if the successor doesn't run the company well, they can't afford the cash flow to pay it.
That's the nightmare that a lot of owners are concerned about. Is not only if they sell to it's the same. If you sold to an outside buyer and they run the company into the ground, you get back your company as a shell. Nobody wants that. No, you know,
nope.
Nobody wants that. But here, it's even worse because you're familiar with who your new buyers are. And so now it sets up this awkwardness that I turned it over to you and you ran it into the ground and now I'm back and oh my gosh, that's just, it's, and then again, toggle another switch. It's a family member. You ruined
mm-hmm.
my retirement.
Yep.
You know,
yep. I gave you a
well-run company and you ran into the ground. That's difficult.
So it's really very critical go ahead, Bill.
No, I was just going to say, so what you've developed is a coaching process. You've written a book called A Listening Excellence, Bringing Out the Best in People, so people can read about this, and that's available on Amazon, iBooks, and Barnes & Noble, I see, which is great. And
yes.
Then you also have a successor readiness assessment. that people can take at your website. And we'll get into that, and we'll also put the link. If you're listening to this, you'll find the link on our podcast website. So tell us a little bit about that. Who should read the book? Obviously, everybody should read the book. It's a business owner. Who should take the successor readiness assessment? And should it be like anybody who should the successor take it, or should the owner take it, I guess, is my question.
You know, I think either one, certainly the owner ought to take an
okay.
Not take the assessment, but essentially give the assessment. This assessment is a set of questions, 28 questions, that need to be asked. And they examine all the things that you brought up. They examine the owner's role, interaction with the successor. It examines the successor and how well they're prepared to become an owner and to make decisions. And it won't develop anybody, but it will give an owner, it'll give an advisor, if an advisor uses the assessment as a tool, it'll give anyone who's looking at this a sense of, is the successor really ready to take over, or do they need development? And it's a great tool. I mean,
so it's a diagnostic tool. When you take a look, when you take your car in for service, the first thing they do is they hook it up to a diagnostic situation to see what are all the problems that are happening, what are all the vital signs. So this is a diagnostic tool that owners can have their potential successors take, and then what happens? They get back a report of some kind, or they get in touch with you, or how do they
It's not. It's not online at all. It's a downloadable PDF. They can take it. They can sit down with it and have discussions between the owner and the successor. It's very easy to use. And if you come to the conclusion that the successor actually does need development, then we've got a very comprehensive 360 leadership assessment that it produces like a 40 or 50 page report. And it gives us the insights to help that person be a rock star. Because I'll tell you what, and I'll bet you'll echo this, Bill, that in all my years of working with owners and executives, I've never met one who thought they were a poor leader.
Mm-hmm.
No one
says,
you know, I'm a poor leader. They'll all say, well, you know, I can improve, but I think I'm pretty effective. And yet we all know that there are many poor leaders. And so an assessment like not a self-assessment, but a 360 assessment is a great tool for someone to really get an objective view of how effective they are.
That's great. And so tell us a little bit about your book, Eliciting Excellence, Bringing Out the Best in People.
Best in People. It's a book I published last year. It's a leadership book, and it's a book about – well, it's the concept that in order to be an excellent leader, it's about bringing out the best in people. Yes, it's important to make good decisions and be strategic, but if you've ever heard the expression, culture eats strategy for lunch, it's about a good strategy will produce mediocre results if people aren't engaged in executing it. Where the same strategy executed by a team of engaged folks produces spectacular results. And the studies have shown that the difference in ROI can be literally 2 to 3-fold. And my perspective and the perspective in the book is that the way you get people engaged, the way you bring out the best of them, is to be a great leader. And so the book goes through several areas on how to be that great leader. And it's about managing ourselves. It's about managing the team, and it's about managing leading ourselves, leading the team, and leading the organization. And those are the areas of the book. And there's some practical steps throughout the book. So it's chunked down so it's easy to read.
Well, that's what our owners need is they need the information from people that are out there seeing it and doing it, helping people, and also, you know, succinct enough that you can get some actionable steps out of it. And again, just if you're listening to this, just go to school on being a better leader and planning your successor leadership, because it will make all the difference in the world when that day comes when you're passing the baton to your company. Or it doesn't matter if you're passing the baton to those people. You could be saying, I want to sell the company. That one of the key things you're going to be looking at is who's next in line to run this thing. That's a key indicator from every M&A interview we've ever done, Michael, and everybody I've ever talked to. They say the 2 to 3 times weighted decision is going to be on who are your people and how capable are they to run this business. So thank you so much. I mean, it's been fascinating. I could go on for much longer, and I hope we can talk again soon, because it's been fascinating.
I would love that.
I really wish you the best of luck. Now, your website is www.michaeljbeck.com, michaeljbeck.com, and your
yep.
email address is mbeck@michaeljbeck.com. Very simple. So for listeners, if you want to get that assessment tool, we'll have the link on our website, or you can just simply email Michael at mbeck@michaeljbeck.com. And fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for joining us.
Fantastic. Thanks so much again for having me, Bill.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks, Michael. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this, so please stay with us.
Hey, everybody, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.